The BioWorld Insider Podcast.
This is the BioWorld Insider Podcast. I'm Lynn Yaffe, BioWorld's publisher. Our guest today is Mark McKenna, the CEO of Mirador Therapeutics. Mark was the CEO of Prometheus Biosciences in 2023 when the company was sold for $10.8 billion to Merck. He found that he could only sit on the sidelines and watch for a very short time. He jumped right back into drug development less than a year later by launching Mirador with a $400 million seeding. That's one of the largest financings so far this year. The company is taking a tailored approach to developing therapies for immune-mediated inflammatory and fibrotic diseases. He has a lot of experience starting at Johnson & Johnson, then at Bausch & Lomb for more than a decade, and later as a president of Salix Pharmaceuticals. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Lynn. Appreciate you having me.
Mark is here today to talk with Lee Landenberger, BioWorld staff writer and the BioWorld Insider host. He's talking about Mirador and the pharma landscape in general. Over to you, Lee.
Thanks, Lynn. And Mark, thanks again for joining us today. You and I talked in late March when Mirador launched, and it was a great conversation. It was wide-ranging, and I thought, why not talk some more with you? So I invited you on the podcast, and you were nice enough to say yes. So welcome.
Well, I enjoyed the initial dialogue as well. Thanks for covering the launch of Mirador Therapeutics, our new company. We're beyond excited for the potential that this could provide for patients that are suffering from chronic immune-mediated diseases and to get the band back together and complete the mission. So thanks for having me here. I'm excited to talk about all things Mirador, walk you through the Prometheus journey as well, and discuss, as you said, wide-ranging issues in pharma and healthcare.
Yeah, well, let's launch Mirador right now. Again, you raised $400 million to get the company going, and that's one of the largest financings of the year. How'd you go about that in such a tough market?
Yeah, it was a very different than the first go-around with Prometheus, where we didn't have the established relationships, we didn't have the track record, we didn't have the team assembled. In this situation, I think that what started out as an idea in my family room with my chief scientific officer later became, you know, full-blown company. And I think that over the summer post the exit of Prometheus, many of us had some soul-searching to try and figure out what we wanted to do when we grew up. And for me, while there was a lot to weed through with regard to different opportunities, both board and operating roles, to me what it came down to is there was a lot of unfinished business at Prometheus. There was a team that was in place that was a well-oiled machine. And, you know, we started having conversations with investors about raising $100 million or $200 million. And what we found out is that there was incredible enthusiasm for what we could potentially build together once again as a team. And, you know, that really laid the groundwork for, you know, where we landed at $400 million. More important than the $400 million is the fact that there was a lot of enthusiasm around immunology and precision immunology and what could be in terms of cracking this efficacy ceiling. Today, you know, you look at, you know, multi-billion dollar drugs like Humira, they still are providing, you know, suboptimal efficacy levels to patients in key areas like inflammatory bowel disease, RA, and others. For example, in inflammatory bowel disease, you know, Humira provides 10 to 15% clinical remission. You know, that means that, you know, 85% of patients are not currently having their needs met. And they're dealing with a very chronic, debilitating disease where many of them know go to the bathroom 10 to 15 times a day. They know where the restrooms are on the way home from work. And this impacts, you know, people, everyday people. This is not a rare disease. You know, there's 5 million people globally that, you know, are afflicted with inflammatory bowel disease. So the idea that we were going to just, you know, provide one treatment and be done, I think that I think we can do better. And I think that with this $400 million, I think there's plenty of ways that we can continue to improve the efficacy for these patients and change lives.
So talk to me a little bit, if you would, about the science behind the company and how you want to, you know, what the mechanisms are that you're working with. And I assume it's sort of a background follow-up question to that is that why the company appears to be so valuable to investors?
Well, we're still running somewhat in semi-stealth. And today, I think when you disclose what you're working on, particularly given the success that we've had, you're going to have many fast followers behind you, many of which coming in China and other parts of the world. So we've been very careful about what we shared and who we shared it with. And I would just say that for those large check writers in our financing that did get some visibility, clearly a lot of enthusiasm for the potential of what we were building. But we've been very careful about, you know, how we're disclosing what we're working on. What we said more broadly is, you know, there are key clusters that we want to focus on as Mirador. We want to focus on the GI tract, the lung, particularly lung fibrosis, as well as the skin. And I think that there is a ton of unmet need in those areas. And, you know, we're not trying to be all things to all people, but what we are going to be doing is, you know, following the playbook that we wrote, which is, hey, we want to take a genetic approach to drug discovery and bring precision medicine from end to end. And what I mean by that is this will be the first time that someone takes a drug in terms of this, the discovery effort, to the indications that are selected, to how you develop the either the chemistry or the antibody, to the how you run the clinical trials in terms of patient enrollment, to stratification on the back end, where you think about, you know, whether it's a complementary diagnostic or some other way to stratify patients. This is what we talk about when we say end-to-end, where it's really, you know, not a one-size-fits-all drug, but something that is tailor-made for that particular patient. And I think the playbook is clearly there in oncology, maybe not perfectly perfected. And there's a number of notable differences, mainly that we're not looking for one association. We're looking for, you know, polygenetic signatures in most cases. And we're looking for functional genomics as well. And look, there's, you know, ways to even evolve precision medicine in terms of stratification even beyond that. And that's exactly where we're going, is where is this market going to be 3 to 5 years from now? And we want to absolutely be the market leader in terms of precision immunology. And I think we have the team capability, we have the data to be able to really pioneer this space.
You had mentioned that trials, clinical trials, that would be smaller. That's the way you envision them for the company, instead of much larger ones. And that means less money spent and less time in development. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's at the core of the thesis here, is that by having a more selective enrollment process, you can run smaller trials, faster enrollment periods, less cost. The playbook for that is in oncology. I think what we've yet to, you know, this is still being digested by regulators in the other areas outside of oncology. But as you start to, you know, bring forth transformational therapies that, you know, materially move the needle, I think that's how you're going to start to see more rapid type of approvals and access to the markets. I think a good case study here is you look at cell therapy. There's a lot of promise in this area. There's a lot of risks that are still ahead of us. But you think about areas like lupus, very severe patient populations, and you know, you have potentially curative treatments in cell therapy, but are they going to, you know, when you're getting 75-80%, you know, remission rates, are you going that are durable over a year? Are you really going to make them follow a traditional development path? I personally don't believe so. Time will tell what that looks like. But I'm incredibly excited for the opportunity to bring forth data that is going to change the way we develop drugs in this area. And there's an alternative agenda here. Obviously, you know, we're patient focused and we believe that we can do better for these patients. We believe we're the best hope for bringing forth transformational therapies in this area. That's why we're back at it. But the other agenda here is immunology is the number one drug spend category in the U.S. So if you actually want to tackle drug spend while getting patients better outcomes, which I think is the panacea that everyone talks about, you know, I believe that there's really, you know, three ways to do it. One is, you know, new MOAs, you know, new drugs that provide differentiation. Number two, it's precision medicine, where you identify subsets of the population that can benefit from a particular drug. And then finally, combination therapy. And we intend to tackle all three of those over time. But, you know, if we're able to move the efficacy bar in this area, it's going to result in huge drug savings, cost savings while still giving patients better treatment options. That gets me excited.
I'd like to jump in here with a question, Lee.
Yeah.
Mark, so when you start talking about tailor-made drugs for patients, and obviously we want better results for those patients, you start thinking about very expensive therapeutics. Are you already planning on pricing at this stage and how to position that in terms of value?
Yeah, no, it's a fair question. I think that you're absolutely right that historically speaking, you've had, when you go after rare diseases, given the limited patient populations that you're going after, oftentimes you see these drugs that are very expensive. I would remind you that there's 5 million patients globally that have inflammatory bowel disease. And so if you find a drug that works in 20% of them, that's still not a rare disease. All that is a way to get to those patients faster. And the agency should reward these type of initiatives because they result in better patient outcomes and as well as cost savings. So to me, this doesn't have to be a rare disease type of scenario, particularly when you're going after these very large markets. I think that, we're always going to price for value, but the strategy going in is not setting up a market that can be, nefariously exploited. It's quite the opposite. It's like there's a huge problem out there that has been unsolved. We brought forth very expensive treatments that are, basically hammers for the immune system. And we found that those don't result in materially different outcomes. And I think the Humira case study and all the other agents that have followed is the case study that we should look at. So, we should talk more about this on a separate podcast or later in this podcast, because I think there's just a lot of misinformation about pharma pricing and pricing for value. The strategy here is better outcomes, lower cost.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about it now if you like. Did you have further thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think that over the last 20 years in various political cycles, we've seen, this rhetoric around pharma pricing. And don't get me wrong, there's been a few bad actors. That being said, on whole, the innovators in this space have been agents for change and for good. And without them, we wouldn't have, solved the COVID crisis. We would, still be wearing masks every day. And I think that when you take a look at what's broken in our system today, it's not the innovators. What is broken is our system, where you have middlemen basically, collecting rebates, taking, apparently, allegedly negotiating on behalf of employers, but taking these massive rebates, acting as middlemen, where they provide next to no value in the system. And I'm talking about the PBMs. I've seen firsthand, working in this ecosystem over the last 20 years, negotiating with the payers, kind of how flawed our system is. And until we actually deconstruct that, we're not going to get to a situation where we have healthcare for all, and we're not going to get to better treatments for patients. And I think we should be rewarding the innovators. And the last comment I would make in this space is that this is one of the few segments in the American economy where the U.S. is still the undeniable market leader. And do we really want to outsource our R&D to other places around the world that to either friend or foe? And I think that we should think very carefully about that. And so rather than demonizing those who are actually doing, spending billions of dollars at risk to bring therapies to the market, let's reconstruct the market and take out the middleman who provide no value in the system, yet extract a disproportionate amount of economics out of the system that could go to lowering drug prices.
Were you seeing that at Prometheus or even probably earlier? But I'm curious when that first became something in your sights.
I think I had an aha moment when I went to Prometheus, going from a large pharma company to a biotech where trying to raise capital and fund these large development projects, there was a realization that there is an extraordinary cost to bringing these drugs to market. Over $1 billion in many cases or more to get these to market. And a lot of the times this is binary. the drug either works or doesn't work. And yes, you can get something that's on the margin, but I don't think that's what any of us are playing for. We're playing for transformational therapies. And so, yes, coming into the biotech arena where you have to raise capital and every dollar that you spend is precious, you realize that drug development is extraordinarily hard. It's super expensive. And it kind of reinforced what I saw on the other side at large pharma negotiating with the payers where, you know, incentives are not aligned. And I think we need to focus on what's best for patients. And I think that this idea of bringing precision medicine into immunology is a great way to reduce drug costs and improve healthcare outcomes.
So when you were putting Mirador together, was that part of the plan? Because you brought back a lot of execs to work with you from Prometheus. Was this a part of your discussion?
No question. I think the broader strategy and unmet need that remains in this market was the underpinning for the company and really, you know, the thesis behind why we exist. I think the, Mirador in Spanish means the vantage point, the lookout. And we believe that based upon, you know, what we've accomplished together as a team, and the data that we have via Mirador 360, which is our proprietary data set, gives us a unique view on immunology and the immune system. And we're not just developing one drug against one target. We're, you know, doing drug discovery through this large data set where we're looking for leverage this asymmetry of information that we have to bring forth new therapies, new mechanisms, new precision approaches. And to me, the secret sauce here is the team. And we couple that with some of the world's leading investors, you know, Arch Ventures, OrbiMed, Fairmount Funds, along with, you know, a dozen other top-notch investors, Fidelity, Point72, Woodline, Venrock, so on and so forth, so many to name. But these are, the innovators in the space that are making the bets on entrepreneurs, they're making the bets on science. And, when you couple this team with this capital, this group of investors, this board that we've assembled, man, this could be a lot of fun. And the aim is to transform outcomes for patients in this area. And I think if we focus on inputs and building a great company, no doubt great things are going to come.
Last month, you and I were talking about the economic landscape for companies operating in pharma. And at the time, you said that the market looks fundamentally different today than it did a few months ago. And I think what you meant, that was a sign that you felt better times were ahead. We felt like the Fed was going to tamp down interest rates. And now inflation is still more of a thing than thought even a month ago. Do these new numbers change your outlook at all?
I think in the last 30 days, you've seen a retrenchment in the XBI, and the majority of that can be attributed to the rising or lack of deflation. And, you know, you look at biotech, it's a highly correlated to interest rates. Why? Because none of these companies are actually generating, or most of them are not generating a profit. These are investment intense businesses that require lots of capital at risk. And so when interest rates go up, it has a negative impact on the XBI, which is the biotech market. And so, yeah, I think that we are far from out of the woods here. And I'm not an economist, but I would say that seeing it firsthand here on the ground, you're seeing a bifurcation of the market where those that have A-plus science and A-plus teams are able to raise money. Those, you know, with less track records or less compelling science or focusing on areas that are not in vogue are more challenged to raise capital. I actually think that's pretty healthy. You know, the juxtaposition to that would be, you know, 2020 and 21, where capital was free flowing and every company was getting invested in getting funded. I'm not sure that's a healthy market. You just take a look at success rates in biotech. If you're making sprinkling bets on every company, eventually that the music's going to stop there. So you got to be more proficient at picking winners and losers. And so I think that the rise in interest rates, the challenges in the market of creating, you know, two different worlds where, you know, again, certain companies can easily raise money and others have more challenges. I think long-term this works to the benefit of the market because we're getting the better science funded and seeing more consolidation in the space on teams and science.
Okay. We've covered a lot of ground, and we could probably drill a lot deeper on some certain topics, but what is there anything, Mark, that we have not talked about that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we should dive into more is like the outlook going forward, because I think this is a question I get a lot from investors and from other other journalists is, well, what's going to happen in the market as you think about the loss of exclusivity and some of the pressures that face the big pharma companies over the next 10 years? You take a look at the fact that, you know, between 2023 and 2030, these large companies are going to, you know, lose circa $320 billion in revenue, and as a result of LOEs, where their patents expire. And what does that mean for the market? And for me, I think that, again, this is healthy, but it's also going to require them to restock the shelves with innovation, both organically and then also through acquisition. And so I suspect that, you know, there's going to be continue to be a lot of M&A in the space in order to replace the revenues from key drugs like Keytruda and other Humira, other multi-billion dollar drugs. And the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed about, 18 months ago, 2 years ago now, puts further pressure as it creates another challenge for these pharma companies, particularly those that are working on small molecules, to recoup their investment in a shorter period of time. I think that, you know, the IRA is probably having an opposite effect with regards to, one, reducing inflation, and two, actually lowering drug cost, because it's doing it in a way that provides perverse incentives and has drug developers not pursuing the best science. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a way to do this where it can improve outcomes and also reduce cost. I think that the last thing I would say is that this ecosystem, there's probably a misunderstanding of how the ecosystem works, particularly amongst regulators. This is not a typical market where you see consolidation being bad. You actually need consolidation in order to create a healthy market. Given the amount of capital that's needed to run large phase three trials, that's oftentimes not best done by a small biotech company, but rather by a large pharma company who has the know-how and resources to do that. So, we've seen intense, pressure by the FTC over the last 2 years to push back on various deals in the segment. And I think a lot of times it comes, the impact there is it's negative for patients. And it's negative for the ecosystem. We coexist together and need one another to be successful. And it's unlike other areas in tech where consolidation can lead to monopolies. One of the biggest travesties, I think, in healthcare that I've seen in the last 20 years is allowing the payers to vertically integrate, where you have the PBMs and the health plans and the pharmacies all being owned by the same entity. How do we allow that to happen? Yet we're worried about one pharma company buying another company where there's plenty of competition in the market. And so once again, these are like large problems that we need to sort out together. And I think that a active M&A market is very healthy for biotech and for patients.
Got it. Man, this is great. We could just go on for a while here, but I think this is a good time to stop. Mark, I really appreciate your insights, and I want to wish you the best of luck, you and everybody else at Mirador, and I look forward to talking to you when you get into the clinic.
Sounds good. Lee, thanks so much. Thank you, Lynn, and look forward to chatting again very soon.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. We certainly look forward to covering all of the incremental updates in BioWorld. That's our show for today. As always, BioWorld will continue to keep you informed of all the most important scientific, clinical, regulatory, and business updates. We're a daily news service covering drug development. If you need to track the development of human therapeutics, turn to BioWorld.com. Follow us on X, and you can email us at newsdesk@BioWorld.com to get in touch. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite platform. Thanks for joining us today.
BioWorld, published by Clarivate, is a subscription-based news service that delivers actionable intelligence on the most innovative therapeutics and medical technologies in development.